The Learning Edge, a dialogue with Chris Mercogliano and Stephen Harrison, was recorded live in Boulder, Colorado in 2007. Following this program is an interview of Chris with Connie Shaw, owner of Sentient Publications. This audio program was produced by Wetware Media, publishers of digital content presenting the provocative and original perspectives of influential authors, speakers, and visionaries. For more information, please visit www.wetwaremedia.com. That's WETWAREMEDIA.com. Chris Mercogliano was a teacher at the Albany Free School for 35 years and stepped down as director in June 2007 to concentrate on writing and speaking about non-controlling education and child rearing. His essays, commentaries, and reviews have appeared in numerous publications as well as in four anthologies. He's the author of Making It Up As We Go Along, The Story of the Albany Free School, Teaching the Restless, One School's Remarkable No Ritalin Approach to Helping Children Learn and Succeed, How to Grow a School, Starting and Sustaining Schools That Work, and his most recent book, In Defense of Childhood, Protecting Kids' Inner Wildness. Stephen Harrison is an international speaker on the topics of consciousness, human development, relationship, and alternative education. He's the author of Doing Nothing, The Happy Child, and What's Next After Now, Post-Spirituality and the Creative Life.
Well, all that you're talking about, maybe we can start here actually in the official recording, but this actually brings up really in a way the topic that I'd like to talk a little bit about with you, which is how to engender this creative movement with children and with ourselves in the face of the fact that it does seem like creativity oftentimes comes from the collapse, the breakdown, the losing of what we know, and the space of unknowing, and then the emergence of the new.
Right.
Now, you know, as adults, we can begin to recognize that, even though we can see it's really difficult to go through. We always have the attachment to the thing we know, and we feel the pain of it leaving. But we know that there's something emerging, and then it emerges. With children, it seems like this cycle happens very rapidly oftentimes, and it looks like chaos, or it looks like something that's not very attractive to the adult mind. And so I guess I'm interested in both, for you, since you've been in this mix with these kids and with yourself and with the other staff in the school,
right.
It's all kind of, to me, all put together into this big field. And somehow there's a magic about when the parents, the teachers or the staff and the kids are all in that field together, and there's great disharmony when any component of that is not in that field. You know, staff steps back from it and tries to resist it or tries to hold it in one place. So I'm just interested in how you saw that kind of thing playing out in your experience in the past and maybe your experience now.
Well, there's certainly a child's perception of order or disorder and an adult's perception of order or disorder, you know, tend to be pretty different. I mean, of course, it depends on the child and it depends on the adult. I mean, we're all sort of configured differently based on our temperament, personality, and so on. But I mean, the thing that I'm totally clear about, having worked very closely with kids and all kinds, I mean, literally all kinds of kids, for 3.5 decades, is that children in their natural state, you know, and I really believe there is such a thing as children in their natural state. Not quite in the way Rousseau had it, and, you know. I mean, Rousseau didn't really know a damn thing about real children. He gave his away. He made his wife give him away. Because it would have been too big a distraction. He wanted his freedom
to write about it
and pontificate and, you know, whatever, be the man. So his wife would have babies and they would give them away. Isn't that pitiful? Oh, yeah. Yeah, little known facts about it. Anyway, so children in their natural state are just automatically and constantly seeking out a couple of things, especially if we're talking about education, we're talking about learning, development, growth. And what they're seeking is kind of a deeper understanding of their environment. They just truly, you know, we call it curiosity. You know, children are curious. It's kind of a truism, but anyway, it's really true. There's a powerful inner drive that we're all born with to understand our surroundings, to know what's going on, to have some sort of mastery over, not dominance or control over, but a competence. Maybe that's a better word. Children have a natural drive. Instinctive natural drive to be competent. And they have an instinctive desire for novelty and pleasure. I mean, children in their natural state really are playful. I mean, again, that's another truism. But they are. Children naturally, you know, just to use the plainest English, children like to have fun. They want to have fun. That's their drive, is to have fun. To do exciting, curious, different things all the time. I mean, they want to do this all the time. Children in the natural state, they abhor routine. And that varies a little bit, in my experience, by temperament, personality. Some kids, again, you know, want more order in their world than others. But still, even the most orderly kid, in my experience, you know, given the choice to shed routine in order to do something different, something interesting and new, they'll do it. They're not going to, you know, they're only going to stay on that one path for a certain amount of time. They're going to get bored with it, and they're going to want to try something else. You know, those innate drives or desires are totally sufficient to propel a child's development and growth. They have needs. They have emotional needs, and when they're little kids, they need help in staying safe, and you know, they need protection sometimes. They need, you know, they need some guidance. They need all kinds of levels of support, you know, the younger they are, and then as they grow more mature and more competent and bigger and stronger and so on, they take over, you know, they need less and less of that external support, and they're able more and more to generate that kind of the support they need, you know, internally with their own resources.
But the tension.
But it's very chaotic. I mean, I want to go back to your point of chaos. Yeah. But if you create an artificial institution, you know, called a school, and say, well, it's some place with the purpose of children, you know, learning and becoming more mature and so on, and you've got a whole collection of children that are individually being self-propelled, and you have a limited physical space and so on. Especially if your physical space is limited. I guess if you have an unlimited amount of space, it's not so okay. I mean, I've actually been to schools where it isn't so, because they have like warm climate places where kids can be, you know, it's just fine to be outdoors because it's never cold, it doesn't snow. I've been down into Florida, I've been to Southern California to schools that don't control kids very much. But in northern climes where I'm from, sure, it becomes, there's always a level of chaos. It's too noisy sometimes. But generally the kids don't perceive it that way. Mm. It doesn't bother them. Mm. And they could care less if it's too noisy. Mm. The hell do they care?
Yeah, so if you have the you know, the parent, the staff, and the kids all fine with just an open space, with kids being driven by creativity and by curiosity and by novelty, and that's it, then you have this what I would think of as a field,
right,
in which something can emerge.
Right, exactly.
What I see taking place, though, is in that field there are, let's say, constructs that enter, like the idea that my kid should learn fill in the blank,
right,
or a government that says all kids should learn fill in the blank, or even a kid that says, you know, my friend who's going to a regular school is learning fill in the blank. So there's a kind of thing that emerges as an obstruction to that space, which says, curious, novelty-seeking kid should also learn specific things.
Right.
And that tension then begins to interfere, it seems to me, with that field. And it starts to create a kind of tension.
Mm-hmm.
And then that tension becomes oftentimes what the school is about, dealing with, relieving, facing down that tension, rather than the field itself. This is one of the challenges that I see in the school that we operate here.
Right.
So I'm interested in how that occurred in your, in the schools that you've been involved in or observed. Is there ever a space in which that field is just opened, in which it truly the connectivity between the staff, parent, and child, and society for that matter, is really allowing that field to fully explore and develop?
Very well said.
Very well said. Political situation of facing and pushing back the forces.
No, I don't think necessarily. I mean, I totally agree with you that as a society we have accepted the belief, or the, you know, I would say the myth, that you know what we call learning, you know, has to have a certain measure of unpleasantness, and it has to be perceived as work. You know, it's kind of almost taps into the whole Protestant, you know, which, you know, we have to remember that's our whole school model was based, it was started by Calvinists in New England,
right,
with a dash of Prussian, you know, because they went to Prussia to check out, you know, how great they're, anyway. So, you know, this whole idea that learning can just be pleasurable, you know, runs completely against that, that ethic, and, you know, kind of pisses people off, really. And then, of course, as you say, that parents, especially, you know, today more than ever, always some, but today way more than ever, are being bombarded with fear-based messages about their children on every front, not just education, you know, about health and safety and, you know, every other damn thing, but certainly about education. So parents are on edge more than ever about whether or not their children, you know, are going to make it, are keeping up. So kind of in my idiom, the way I express it is, especially for parents, parents end up really anxious about their children. I mean, the best definition I ever read of anxiety, well, it might have been Fritz Perls that said this back in the day. Anxiety is just like frozen energy. The nature of energy, especially human energy, but nature of any energy, is it wants to move. It wants to flow.
Right, right.
And we won't go into the psychology of it, but what Perls would have said is, for whatever reason, when your energy, when your own energy in your body isn't flowing for whatever reason, you experience it. It's unpleasant, you know, it's because it's going against sort of the laws of, you know, human nature. And you experience it in this unpleasant way. It's still just energy, but because it's there, but it's not moving anymore. And it doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It feels, you feel it as, you feel a discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, this parental anxiety, you know, here you've got the child, as we've said, you know, just kind of humming along, just like, wow, look at this, and I want to find out about that, and I'm going to do this now, and I'm going to do that now. And their energy is just flowing. And it's flowing in just the direction they need it to flow in, according to their needs and their unique identity and all that good stuff. But they're also, you know, children are so tethered, not tethered, but, you know, that umbilical cord, that energetic, emotional umbilical cord, you know, never gets severed, never falls off. Children are, especially younger children, they are just emotionally connected to their, they know exactly how their parents feel at every moment. They just know, they feel it. It's not a rational thing. So if the parents start becoming anxious, you know, what did you do at school today? Well, you know, I played with Legos and, you know, and dug in the sandbox and, I don't know, we played chase and, you know, we had lunch and well, I don't know, hung out for a while with Jimmy and, you know, we, I don't know, we're just talking and, you know, and that happens too many days in a row. And,
exactly.
And parents are like, well, what else did you do? Well, you know, and then...
How about math?
And the children could just tell, you know, even if the parents don't say anything, it's just they know, and they feel it. Uh-oh. Mom's worried. Dad's worried. I'm not doing enough in school. I'm not learning, you know, my times tables or whatever. And they just have no defense against that anxiety. It's just a direct transmission. And so they start carrying it. and then they carry that to school with them. And then, you know, it starts, it can kind of contain, then their energy starts, it stops flowing in that full, beautiful way. And they fall into unnatural, habitual behaviors, avoidance behaviors, because they don't feel good anymore. So maybe then, yeah, okay, I'm going to play, you know, video games are a great distraction. You don't feel anything when you're playing, but I'm not anti-video game necessarily, but they're beautifully distracting. You feel nothing. You are so absorbed by the connection between you and the game. So yeah, it's a problem. So in our school, so is it a fatal problem? You know, no. It's generally, at least in our school, it was an individual problem. Some parents would feel more anxious than others. I mean, we would kind of generally, any given year, have the whole range from severely anxious parents who ultimately take their child out to parents that really understood how it works. Or maybe, you know, once in a while, maybe a parent who actually went to an uncontrolling school as a child themselves. So they actually do understand, because they actually were lucky enough to have gone to that kind of school. So they actually know, well, you know, it actually does work. It worked for me, you know. So I can say with confidence, I've seen plenty of parents who weren't anxious about the process. They were really relaxed and okay with their children playing a lot in school. Perhaps learning to read at a later age, perhaps almost never doing any math, but still, you know, learning enough basic skills, you know, to be competent, deal with money and, you know, time and so on, whatever. And so what you would see with those parents and those children is those children just, they're that's why I know that it isn't just theoretical, this idea that children are innately curious and they want to learn and blah, blah, blah. It's actually true.
Right.
Especially when that anxiety tension doesn't, you know, invade and throw up the obstacles you're talking about. It just is true. Children, and they just, their intelligence unfolds. It really does. It is an unfolding. It isn't something that requires management from the outside. It doesn't require, well, how is he going to know about physics if someone doesn't expose him to physics? How can he choose to, you know, to learn the Pythagorean theorem if he doesn't know what the Pythagorean theorem is? And this sort of, you know, that's the classic argument against, you know, sort of non-directive education, letting kids kind of, you know, let them truly follow their interests. What I see is kids, they do. They'll find, if they're really bent on geometry, they'll find the damn, they'll want to learn. Teach me the Pythagorean theorem. Teach me, you know, I want to do some science. I want to learn about this. Nothing gets left out.
Yeah, one of the challenges of the neurotic parent, and I'm one of them, is that I can't find any way of analyzing or understanding my own children's progression without referring to my own past. I have nothing else to refer to, only my own experience.
Right.
And so I'm looking to replicate my experience in a child who's having their own experience. And this is the tension that I think exists for a lot of parents.
Of course.
When I went to school, I learned this. When I, you know, had this experience, it was like that. And so there's this constant referring to the past and to systems that are quite antique, as they already were when we learned.
Right.
And now we're still trying to bring them forward into today's kids. And this seems to be a fundamental insight for a parent to see that they have to step out of their own reference point in order to even see their own child. Now that's a big step. If they can do that, and this again goes back to this breakdown of the known and this open space and then the emergence of the new for the parent.
Right.
Now the child, it seems to me, is doing this. As you've described, children, until they absorb that neurotic mind and taking that in as their own, they're in a pretty clear space about this. They don't mind failing. They don't mind experimenting. They don't mind falling down and cycling through. They may fall down. They may cry. They may scream. They may see if they get attention.
Right.
But then a second later, they're laughing and skipping along merrily. So their cycle is so quick.
Right.
For the parent, somehow we've learned to try to freeze those cycles so that we don't fall down.
Right.
And then we'd say, well, my job as a parent is so that my kid never falls down. And you, as a school, have to keep my kid from falling down.
Right. You know? Exactly.
And so this whole sort of prevention of the child's exploration sets in. And what's interesting to me is that right now the cutting edge of leadership training is talking about essentially retraining corporate people to be able to fall down, to be able
to be self-organized.
Yeah,
self-organization is huge. That's funny. You Google self-organization now, and it's not just left-wing physicists. It's the corporate core of America.
So
totally bought into it.
All the things that, let's say, a free school would suggest it's attempting to engender in a child is now desperately wanted at corporate levels because they can't find these attributes.
Right. But they have to reprogram the adults to get there. Yeah.
And yet when the typical parent looks at the child, they say, well, they have to be pushed into this particular way of learning because they won't get a job.
Right.
They won't be successful when they're adults. When they get to be adults, the corporations are trying to unprogram them so that they can function in a more creative way.
No, exactly.
It's an interesting paradox. It doesn't seem to be, all the dots don't seem to be able to be connected right at the moment in the lower levels of education.
Right. Well, and no one's reporting the paradox either.
Yeah. I mean,
you almost never read about it anywhere.
Yeah.
I tried to write about it in the new book.
Yeah.
I don't see much. Education is just such a sacred cow. I still say it is America's most sacred of cows.
Yeah.
We just, we question it a little bit. You know, we question details like, how come our standardized test scores don't measure up with, the Scandinavians or, the Japanese or that kind of thing, little. But overall, we don't. Mm-hmm. We never question anything fundamental about our education model, and not system either, because most affluent kids don't go to public school anyway. They go to a whole series of much more kinder and more interesting private schools where kids get a lot more good attention, all that stuff. But anyway, we don't question it.
Yeah, you can almost understand the parents' neuroses, because in a way the job of the parent is to be neurotic and to be fearful. You can almost see it wired in. The biology of a parent is to be, vigilant and watchful and protective and all that sort of thing, and how that could slip into, the neurotic state. Now, but with a staff person at a free school, you would hope that you would find individuals who maybe have unraveled some of these things. But I would say one of the challenges that we see is finding adults who actually themselves can stay in this field, this creative field. Now the child's there, as we've talked about. The parent is trying to measure that against certain benchmarks from their own past. And there's the staff person who's basically the, the mediator between those worlds in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the staff that we encounter are themselves caught in that idea.
Right.
So where's the liberation point here? I mean, from your experience in the Albany Free School and the schools that you've observed,
there's no easy answer. It's a problem. It took me years in my early teaching career to understand, to relax, back off, let go the urge to control, let go my fear. It just took years. I mean, I think certain things can speed it up. The relaxation or reprogramming or deprogramming or whatever the hell you want to call it. But there's no quick, there's nothing that's quick. What we did at our school, one thing that's helped a lot is to start up an internship program with full-time, year-long interns so that they're in school every day for a whole year. And we don't pay them. We give them room and board. And their idealism, their desire to check out this freer form of education seems to be enough to, they're willing to make the sacrifice, work for nothing. So that seems to help, because they tend to be younger, and that helps a little bit. I think it was good that I started when I was only 19, so I wasn't quite so set in my ways. I was a little more open just to start. So anyway, we have these interns, and they get a whole year's experience where they're not under so much pressure. They know that we're not counting on them to carry the day. They're just helping, and they are very helpful. When we hire new people, when we need to hire someone, we've got these four that usually, at least one of those four, and sometimes several, sometimes it's a sad problem that several of those four want to stay. They fall in love with the whole thing, and they find out they're pretty good at it, you know. And we can't hire them, you know, we can maybe hire one. Then you get to hire the best one, the one who's kind of the farthest along. So it kind of gives you a head start.
Do you see a way of accelerating, let's say, the breakdown of the conditioned perspective?
There's things you can do. I think it's hugely important that any teacher, it doesn't matter what kind of school you teach in, that you work really hard on knowing yourself, on understanding yourself, and on resolving your own inner tangles. You know, dealing with the stuff that you're afraid of, dealing with what makes, you know, you anxious, dealing with depression, whatever. Personally, this is just my belief, that a lot of the fear that any of us have, if we're a staff person in a free school or a parent or whatever, you know, it's really our own fear that we're experiencing.
Right.
It's our own anxiety that we're carrying. And it's also human nature to project that outward onto somebody, onto your children, or your students, or whatever. And just see the world, see everything through anxious eyes, because that's how you're feeling. Yeah. How can you not? If we as teachers can resolve that stuff and learn, you know, what makes us anxious, and learn to free ourselves up internally so that our energy begins to flow freely, I mean, that makes an enormous difference. Then we see children quite differently. Then we don't feel threatened by that sort of chaotic energy that they might generate or whatever. We're like, we understand, oh, okay, that's how that works. We encourage our younger teachers to do that inner work. It's getting a little tougher, and the younger generation doesn't seem to understand, you know, that's, their focus is different, largely, I've noticed. Their focus tends to be more outward. But still, we encourage it, because I think it's just hugely important.
Well, I wonder if that's really not just important, but essential. I mean, this is the question that I think I'm looking at, is when we talk about a school, is that really a contrivance that's really not dealing with the essential thing that is happening, which is a lot of transformation with all the parties there?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a way to talk about that directly, to say, look, this is a space in which what you are is going to break down and something new is going to emerge? For the child, it's going to show up very differently, because they're basically trying out all kinds of personalities and all kinds of behaviors, and they're going to learn through that. For the adult, it's going to be different, because they're stuck in a behavior, they're stuck in a personality. But nevertheless, it's the same movement.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to change the discussion into a field in which transformation is taking place for whoever steps into that field? That seems to me to be what the conversation is turning into, and the question for me is becoming more about that,
mm-hmm.
than this idea of transferring technological information from adult world to child world,
right.
Because clearly that technological information is going out of date so rapidly,
right.
that it's almost a ridiculous premise to do that. You know, I find myself working with my kids, for example, on certain math processes that I myself haven't done for years, because I have a computer and a calculator. I would never add up large columns of 5-digit numbers, because first of all, I'd make a mistake somewhere in there, and second of all, I'd get an adding machine and do it in just one second.
It's a waste of time.
And so when the kid turns me, why am I learning this? Because I can just get a calculator. You see how technology is just moving so rapidly. Now, for some kids, they really love just the balancing of adding numbers and seeing how they come out, and there's a certain kind of beauty to that for them.
Sure.
But for others, it's like, well, that's completely ridiculous.
And they're right.
Yeah. So,
the answer to your question is yes. I think it's possible. Again, if we're just focusing on staff in a freedom-based school, is it possible to help them to understand there's something much deeper going on than just the transfer of information, or
right.
or helping kids to be more sociable, or you know, whatever. But it's also a tall order. I'm not sure how you do it. In the context of my school,
right.
you know, there was just so much day-to-day stuff to take care of mm-hmm. in terms of having 60, 65 kids showing mm-hmm. up every day with all of their issues and moods and right. all of their energy and a whole bunch of staff people having to work together and making sure the bills are being paid and, you know, your budget's going to get you through the year and, you know, and on and on and on. It's a school, even a small school. Absolutely, it's a contrivance. Of course it is. It's totally artificial. But it's still an organism, and it's complex as hell.
Yeah.
And especially if you take on children that are having a hard time, and you've got young staff that have all their issues that they that they've carried with them from their childhoods. That you know they're just at the beginning of understanding themselves. Yeah, I don't know. But how, so how do you do it? I don't think I was creative enough about it. I think looking back, I could have done a much better job of helping young staff and parents too to see the process better, to understand the process, especially the deeper aspects of the process better.
But I
just didn't want to make that investment. At this point, and maybe that's why I've left.
Right, but isn't it also that the clarity of what the process actually is hasn't fully emerged? You see what I'm saying? In other words, you went through it, and it's alive. It's acting on itself, but it's not necessarily at the point where you can give clear expression to it. Now you're writing books.
I hope not. I hope I understand it, but maybe you're right.
But I'm saying, I guess what I see is that there's a certain kind of cultural reflection that comes out of the movement itself. And as that movement occurs, isn't necessarily the time where it reflects itself in culture. So now, for example, you're writing books. Those
right.
books become part of the culture, which then becomes part of what holds the space, which allows mm-hmm. this movement to
That's
continue.
Good.
So this
but I think I just... The step I didn't take, and I'm not going to apologize for it. My life isn't entirely. My life was not entirely about, you know, being a teacher in my little school. I had other parts of my life that I wanted to, increasingly actually, that I wanted to attend to. So the step I didn't take was to stop and look at what I thought my young staff needed to understand better, because I think I know what they needed to understand better, but I didn't stop and say, so what can I do, what can we do as a group? But basically, what can I do to help them? What actual steps, what kind of practices can we, you know, what kind of experiences do they need? How can we sort of speed the process up? Because I think, and think about that creatively, and because it's, that's a real figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Which would take some time and some energy, and I just didn't. I never stopped to do that because I was too busy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would do it on the fly. In situations, I would do it, of course, but I really think that could be done. That you could. It wouldn't be perfect, but you really could put together a set of experiences, a set of processes
mm-hmm.
that young people, these young teachers, could then go through. You know, it wouldn't be perfect, but it really would help. It would speed up their inner growth greatly and just speed up their understanding and they wouldn't have to just learn all of I think you could learn all that stuff on the fly anyway. I certainly did over time, but I mean I think you just could, and that's what I wish to. I may start looking into now that I have time
mm-hmm.
that I'm not 50 hours a week dealing with kids and family stuff and so on. I would love to now give it some thought. So especially in terms of, say, teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can
so
rework that whole process? So what do teachers really need?
Right.
And even not necessarily for a freedom-based school, but what do teachers really need?
Right.
What kind of inner growth and so on do they need in order to be really effective with kids, to truly understand kids, and to be there, to be a conduit, and to be a guide, and to be a facilitator? In all the right ways, because they truly understand both themselves and therefore, what children need and what children are going through. I'm sure there are people that have been giving thought to it here and there. And, That's something I see as a future project for myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what I think, though, goes to the question of what the paradigm is.
Okay.
You know, when we talk about how to prepare a teacher, the question is, for what? And it seems to me that part of what we're trying to come to grips with, and maybe why it's not so clear or hasn't been so clear, is that the paradigm of what a teacher is, what a student is, what a school is,
right,
is actually shifted,
right,
in such a way that we don't really recognize it. And it seems to me that what we're really trying to get at is access to this field, this space, which mm-hmm. is flow or creativity, which teacher, the so-called teacher has to occupy, the so-called parent has to occupy, and the child has to occupy. And then, in that space, when all are in that field, something can actually move.
Right.
But if there's any part of that which is not in the field, which is, let's say, stuck in the past or stuck in the neuroses, however you want to term that,
right,
it's going to put a hook into the whole system. And then the struggle is going to be to unhook.
Right.
So, to me, what I would look at with a so-called teacher would be for that individual and for me in interaction with them to access the field, the space in which all this stuff is going on. And if the teacher can access that space, they can be in that space with the child. In that space with the child, then it seems to me that the creativity is going to flow. And just like the great athlete or the great mm-hmm. politician or the
right.
great scientist, everyone who is good at what they do, or happy, I should say, in what they do, without the evaluation of good,
right,
is describing a flow state. So this is, to me, the question is, can teachers actually be in the flow state? And if they're in the flow state...
They can, but I don't think it's just a mental construct.
No.
And
it's
not something that just can be learned mentally.
Right.
Or by talking about it.
Right, so that's the question of...
That's where... You know, I'm wanting to look now at, so, you know, what kind of experiential processes mm-hmm. can we think up mm-hmm. that will help, mm-hmm. especially young teachers, but any teacher, mm-hmm. but especially beginners who are just coming into it, to, as you say, you know, be able to access that field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's doable. I mean, I've seen examples of it here and there over the years. I remember, I'll never forget, there was this really unusual teacher named Teresa Benzui or something. She was a striking looking woman. She had full blown alopecia, so she just didn't have a hair on her body. And bald as a cue ball and tall and very, very energetic. And she'd been a pretty conventional teacher her whole life. I think when I encountered her, she was probably, you know, up into her 40s, or might have been 50. I can't remember how old she was, but it's a long time ago. But we invited her to our school to do a day-long or weekend-long kind of workshop, just to work with us, you know, in-service training, you know, kind of thing. Her whole focus was learning through the body. And she designed a bunch of really clever stuff for kids. She had a whole method of teaching math all through the body. She had reading stuff, you know, using the body to make the alphabet, and all through dance and movement. She was a dancer. But the thing I remember the most is at one point, we were up in the preschool space with the little tables and the little chairs and, you know, so on. And she had us just get down on the floor, hands and knees, and for a couple of hours, just stay on the floor, move around, crawl, literally crawl like a worm, or just all fours, and don't get up. And just, I don't think she gave us much other instruction. Just experience the space, you know, mm-hmm. from the vantage point of all the 2 and 3 year olds that are running around in that space, mm-hmm. or crawling around in that space every day. Mm-hmm. And just take it in. See what you get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. It was amazing for me. I was like, huh, so that's how that looks like. That's how that table looks.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that chair looks. And that's how the ceiling looks way up there when I'm way down here. And that's how, and then Teresa walked around, you know, on her feet. So she was her 5'9" person walking around. So, well, that's how tall that person is when that grown up. Look, that head is way up there. And look how it looks looking up her nose, and so on and so on. I don't remember all the details anymore, but I remember how profound it was, how much it you know, sort of increased my, you know, empathetic connection with little children, you know, my ability to put myself in a 2-year-old's shoes and really understand, you know, what's going on for them. It was just amazing. So I don't, you know, that's all these kinds of things are possible.
Yeah, to me that
they're not rocket science.
That movement from authority to empathy is really a significant one, but I feel like that movement has already taken place. Like we understand that, and there's another movement which is trying to take place, is taking place, which is from empathy, where I can feel how you feel, or I can connect how you feel, to something which is whole, which is the whole, this is what I'm calling the field,
right,
which is not about object-to-object, but field perception.
Okay.
And I think that may grow out of empathy. In other words, you can't necessarily get there without having the empathy.
I think you have
movement.
To. You have to understand the child's field.
Yeah. And
not just mentally. You have to embody it, feel it.
Right.
If you don't have that information, I think you're not going to go anywhere.
And I see the school, the democratic or interactive free school is very strong in creating child-child empathy because of the relationship work that just takes place in that, where you're not keeping all the kids in their desks and the teachers.
You're dealing with conflict all the time. Sure.
And that's a very, but the question is, how does that move into from the object-to-object or the subject-to-object relationship to the field? And I think that's an interesting challenge. If this is what I feel is we're all trying to get to at this point.
Well, I think kids live in it. If you leave them be, I think they're there personally. But we as adults, if we haven't had the experience, we don't. Mm-hmm. See, my daughters, you know, it's interesting now to watch my daughters as young adults. My younger daughter's still in college, so it's, you know, my older daughter though is done with college, and now she's been teaching at the Brooklyn Free School. She wasn't there the first year. They had a hell of a time the first year. The place was. But then along comes my daughter, and of course I'm bragging about my daughter, but it's not on that level. It's nothing I did for her. You know, it's just the fact that she was born in a free school. She spent the first 14 years of her life, you know, in a free school. And at home, it wasn't much different. You know, we pretty much our parenting. I mean, we were teachers, and my wife and I were both teachers in school anyway, so there wasn't. It was pretty much all the same water that she was swimming in. And so it's fascinating to watch her now as a teacher with really the same kinds of kids that I was. The Brooklyn Free School is, again, very diverse bunch of kids they have. And very, very uncannily similar to what I know. So I'm watching my daughter, you know, do her thing down there. And in terms of the field, she's there still, even though she went to public high school at a ridiculous university that beat any desire out of her, you know, to ever teach in public school. She is just so relaxed and so, she's just so understands what that school is about. Mm-hmm. And she's gradually being able to convey that understanding, you know, to the others, and kind of pull them along. That's kind of speeding everything up. And I see with Lily, as she talks about her students, especially the ones that are troubled and, you know, having a hard time, this is what I noticed right away the first year that, you know, within a month of her starting to teach there a couple of years ago. The way she was describing the kids she was working with, she already had the depth of perception an understanding about what was really going on with those kids, or not going on with those kids, that I'm just coming to now. In other words, I've spent 35 years with experience and learning and reading and researching and to get to where that's her starting point. That's her ground already.
Yeah.
She's just there.
Right. But so are you. So this is an example.
But now, 35 years later.
But this still, to me, this is an example of a field.
Right.
Is that okay, it took you 35 years, and it took her 3 years, or 14, or 20, or whatever.
Or no years on the job. Zero years on the job.
But this is, to me, this is what this whole sense of what the potential of the field is, space.
And then when she and I communicate about these things, it's effortless.
Exactly.
Because we both just see it.
And what emerges from that is new culture.
Yeah.
Because then structure comes up around that, like the Brooklyn Free School as an example.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's how it works. Yeah, but how to get there, I don't know. You know, it's not so simple.
Yeah, the question for me, and I think this is kind of, again, going into some of the work that's being done in leadership areas, is this whole area of whether this field is actually not something that we produce in, but actually something that, let's say, deposits the future into. Or to put it, let me try this, to put it really succinctly, what we know is the past,
right?
And what we're creating has to do with the future. And so in order to get out of the past, we have to allow that to break down, and then we have to simply be present for this deposit from the future.
Okay.
That to me is very encouraging in this respect, is when I look at my own inventory of skills and capacities and yours and everybody that I know, it doesn't seem like it's enough. It just really seems completely hopeless, despite all the energy and effort and the books and that.
Yeah.
But when you look at it from that as the past, and the possibility of this emergent quality coming from an entirely different space, if you will.
Right.
And our job is really to let go of what we know, to allow the breakdown to occur over and over, much like the young child who we observe doing this over and over again. And you see how amazingly creative and dynamic and energetic those spaces are with kids are doing that.
Right.
Our job is to be not a child, because we're not going to revert, but to be open to that same movement of that energy.
Right.
So that's the area that I find myself exploring right now.
Right. Michael Mendeza, do you know about the Touch the Future Foundation in California?
Yeah,
he works
with
Joe Pierce the heart math people and so on. That's exactly what they're working on.
If you start looking, you start to see not dozens but hundreds or perhaps thousands of individuals, organizations all touching into the same area, from MIT to to the small free schools. They're all very interested in this movement.
But you know, paradigm shifts take centuries to, or at least so far they have.
Looking back, they take centuries, but looking as the shift is taking place, they take moments. You know? So our burden is the fact that we travel in time.
Right.
And we carry it all with us. And the other thing, of course, with paradigm shift is, can we even recognize them? You know, if there's a shift taking place now, could we even see it? Because we can only see from that thing we know.
Right, we're in it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I just say the good news is children are already there. They're born there.
Yeah.
Lucky ones get to stay there.
Yeah.
Kids who've lost it, who've had to pull in order to protect themselves or distract themselves, can get back there. It is possible. I see it all the time. And sometimes parents, even though they don't understand it, and they're not there themselves, they don't even know what there is, you know, not in an intellectual way. They can't articulate it. If you tried to articulate that whole idea to them, they just kind of go, what the hell are you talking about? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But they still haven't lost an instinctive desire for their kids to be happy. And it just in my experience in my school, if their kids got to a place where they're really unhappy, you know, they were failing in school or not fitting into school or refusing to go to school or getting in trouble or whatever, at least those parents who recognized that their kids were, you know, hurting, going the wrong direction, and cared enough about their kids and had the time and the space to say, oh, well, let's try something else, and then somehow they find our crazy little school. And even though they don't understand the school's modus operandi very well, they immediately recognize, and I'm sure you've seen this here, they immediately do recognize how much happier their kids, how quickly their kids get happier. Mm-hmm. And they start really loving going to school, and they start waking up earlier and earlier in the morning, and they come home just happier. And from the parents' point of view, easier to deal with, because the parents don't have to fight with them about doing their homework anymore, and so on and so on and so on. And meanwhile, their kids are just there, and they get to stay there. And
what's remarkable?
Amen. You know, is all I can say.
Yeah, what's remarkable is that for most of us, that isn't enough. That our kids are happy. That we're happy. You know, that happiness is somehow the organizing principle. That there's something else, some agitation or something.
Right, but we've got 30 or more families, 40 families back in little old Albany.
That accept happiness. That actually allow happiness in their life.
No, really. And want that, truly want that for their kids. And,
yeah.
And value it that much. That it overrides the anxieties over, you know, learning or, you know, whatever. The deficiencies of the school. Yeah, thank God.
So, Chris, you're on this tour with your biodiesel VW, and when did you start, and where did you start?
I started on the 21st of September, no, 22nd of September, in Albany, New York, where I live. I headed north to the Canadian border. To a little university town called Potsdam, where there's a northern outpost of the State University of New York. Mm-hmm. I met with a group of very conservative teachers-to-be getting their master's in education. That was very interesting.
Have you had some surprising questions along the way?
Not really. I even at that conservative Potsdam, you know, SUNY Potsdam, we didn't talk about education much. I'm really not wanting to do that in a certain way. I'm kind of wanting to break free of that old world, kind of break out of that bubble. So in the things that I had to say about childhood, what I believe is happening to childhood, especially how domesticated childhood's becoming, and then how that's impacting children's inner selves, they got it. I really was amazed, actually, at how receptive they were. And how aware they were already themselves at how childhood has changed, you know, how their childhoods are different from their parents' childhoods, and what some of the implications are. They actually had sort of, some of them, many of them seem to be aware of that.
You're using the phrase inner wildness in your new book, In Defense of Childhood.
Right. Inner wildness is just a name I cooked up for the soul, and particularly, you know, a child's soul. Not that there's any difference between a child's soul and an adult soul, but the book's about childhood and primarily about children. So, you know, I wanted to work with a term that was particularly descriptive of kids. And besides, the word soul is so baggage laden and kind of overworked, you know, I wanted something different. So, and then what does that mean? To me, inner wildness means, you know, it's the spark. It's a child's essence. It's where their deepest creativity comes from. It's where their energy comes from. And also, in my belief, it's where their kind of inner guidance comes from. So there I borrowed from this ancient Greek, classical Greek notion of the daimon. And the Greeks, Plato, Socrates wrote about the daimon, right? Wrote about his own experience with the daimon, his daimon speaking to him at key moments in his life. But anyway, the idea is that in addition to each of us having a soul, we're also born with a companion to the soul called the daimon, whose job is to guide the soul toward fulfilling its destiny. I just loved it when I came across it. I'd already cooked up the idea of inner wildness and so on, but it just fit. It was like, exactly. It's what I've always known to be true, and what my way of teaching has always been based on, the idea that children know. Children know what they need. They know what they want. I mean, unless they've been terribly, you know, programmed or brainwashed or abused or whatever, you know, so that they've had to separate themselves from their instincts. Kids do have this inner guidance system, absolutely do. So that's a major component also of inner wildness. It's part of us that knows deep inside.
And it's your observation that our society is separating the child from that inner sense of knowing, and that guidance through culture, through schooling, right, through all these influences.
Totally. I mean, our society really is saying that children don't know anything.
And taking away from them the opportunity to express that quality of inner wildness and creativity by not giving them the opportunities that we had as children. So not
right. That's what I call the domestication of childhood.
Right.
Childhood no longer, you know, for the average child anyway, it no longer includes the freedom to explore, the freedom to make up your own forms of amusement, the freedom to think your own original thoughts, the freedom to follow your own passions, your own interests, and so on. And you know, you just look at children's play, for instance, and it's almost all packaged now.
So even though I tend to agree with you on this, as I was reading your book, I had this little question popping up.
Okay.
Are you sure that this is not just a case of nostalgia, of, you know, the good old days being good and the current days not being so good? For instance, kids are creating videos they're putting up on YouTube, you know, so maybe technology can also is also that opportunity for creativity and wildness that maybe some of us don't recognize as clearly as the kids do themselves.
No, that's a really good point. No, I don't make a case in the book for technology being evil or electronic media, you know, being inherently evil. It can be extremely useful. It's a tool. It's a medium for expression. Absolutely. I don't believe that the effects of the changes that we're seeing in childhood have completely hit home yet. I think we're beginning to see kind of the early warning signs of trouble that lies ahead if we continue to package childhood and continue to amp up the amount of control over children's, you know, all the aspects of children's lives. I'm more concerned, you know, next generation, the generation after. If we just keep going blindly in the direction we're going, that's my concern. So it's not like, yeah, we haven't turned children into robots yet. There's plenty of imaginative, creative, thank God, children out there living creative, imaginative lives. But also maybe they're the exceptions.
Well, I think where that question came from for me was, it seems like that force in children is so strong.
Thank God.
I had to question, well, can we actually domesticate that, you know, thoroughly? I suspect that we can't. But then there was the section in your book where you talk about nature, about how we're becoming disconnected from nature, of course, not just children, but adults as well. And that really spoke to me because, obviously, when you're out in nature, you feel the wildness in nature, you know, if you really are out there in the wilderness. That seems to be something that nurtures that in people, and that we are losing that connection.
Absolutely. Across the country, even indigenous cultures in America, nations that live way out in the desert somewhere in the Southwest, their children are losing the connect. There are studies that show the extent to which the current generation of children is losing the connection. It's a great worry to the elders of those peoples. And
now your school, the Albany Free School, is an inner city school. So how do you deal with that question there?
Absolutely. I mean, we do the best we can with limitations. We were given several hundred acres of fairly wild land, pristine kind of wildernessy land, only about a 45-minute drive from school.
And of course, even going outside in the city.
Well, that's what I want to say is that I think, of course, ideally, you know, the wilder that natural space is, the better, the richer, the more nourishing it's going to be to a child and to a child's inner wildness. But amazingly, the city park on the corner, you can make do pretty well. The school does have a little pocket park one block away. It's maybe half an acre in size, but it's mostly grass. It's surrounded by bushes. It has three climbable trees. It doesn't have a sandbox, really, but it's got a stretch of dirt that kids can dig in. It's got sticks that fall down out of the trees that kids can use as swords or spears or, you know, whatever the hell they want to use sticks for. And we take kids there all the time. In fact, the kids, it's not even, you don't have to cross a busy street to get there. So kids who are old enough, you know, go up there in small groups. We don't let them go alone, but in small groups, they can go up there by themselves. It's a very natural space. It's got the sky, it's got the wind, it's got the dirt, it's got the grass, it's got the trees to climb. And the interesting thing I love to tell people is that it's also got swings, you know, mostly super safety, modern day, no risk play equipment. But it still has one dangerous piece, which is I love. It's so funny they left this really dangerous little merry-go-round thing that kids are always trampling each other. You know, I can't believe they left that there. They did it just for us. They had to. It was the power of my intention that they left that. They put in a new one even. But anyway, so there's all this play equipment. But what you see when our free school kids go up there is they'll spend 80% of their time climbing the tree, running around, digging in the dirt, hiding in the bushes, making up all kinds of weird fantasy games in the bushes, and 20% of the time on the slide. Mostly the thing they play with is the dangerous merry-go-round thing, because it's so exciting. You know, the swings get boring really fast, and so does the slide. And these are dumbed-down pieces of equipment anyway. You know, they're no fun. But, I mean, our kids don't get, they're just instinctively after the natural part.
I think it's
and chasing cats around, and chasing dogs, and chasing squirrels, and, you know, because there's animals there. There are dogs and cats and squirrels, but that's all right. They're real, live, flesh-and-blood animals, you know. They're out there, you know, doing their natural wild things, so.
Yeah, it's good for people to realize that even in the middle of the city, even if you don't have the park, just going outside, you're still exposed to the elements, you're moving, you're encountering others, and so on.
Exactly. And it's totally important for kids to have that connection. But the key thing, though, that needs to be stressed is, like when we take the kids up to the little park, our little preschoolers, we don't manage their experience in any way. You just have to let them be there. And then let nature take its course, truly. And let them sword fight with the damn sticks. You know, they're not going to... I mean, if they start poking each other's eyes out, okay. If somebody, some kid is that out of control, of course, you don't want...
But no playground referee blowing the whistle.
Well, not at all. And let them sword fight. If that's what they want to do, if it's a mutual, they just want to whack each other, and let them whack each other and cry and get mad. I mean, whatever. But that's what you do with... That's what kids do with sticks sometimes. That's So it's totally, absolutely necessary. You have to leave them alone. See, when the daycare center around the other corner comes and uses that same playground, and they come holding their ropes, and the teachers don't allow them to climb the tree and don't allow them to get dirty, then those kids you either find just kind of standing around depressed, or you find them using the play equipment. That's all they can seem to think to do is go down the boring slide or rock on the rocker toy and, you know, use the merry-go-round.
What is it about play that is critical?
You know, Einstein said, you know, it's off-quoted now, but Einstein said, imagination is more powerful than knowledge. And he's right. Wouldn't he know? And play, especially, you know, what I call real play, as opposed to domesticated play, play that's either mediated by some kind of adult structure, you know, like Little League sports, or, you know, one of these commercial play places, or an electronic game, or a sophisticated toy, you know, some kind of sophisticated toy, which, you know, not there's anything wrong with any of that stuff. I just say that, but it's not real play. Real play is play, and this is Piaget, the great psychologists and theorists of play pretty much all have the same consensual definition that, that real play is something that children generate themselves. It's pure creativity in action, really. It's coming from children's imagination. It's generated by their imaginative selves, period. You know, it's a way, I mean, play is many things, but it's at its core, it's a way that children exercise their imaginations and develop them and solidify them and enrich them, enrich their imagery and so on by creating more. But I think the reason that Einstein is saying that imagination is more powerful than knowledge is because, you know, you have to ask the question, where does knowledge come from? You know, how do we truly access knowledge? You know, how do we truly learn? Again, you know, getting to the essence of the process, it's an extremely creative process. It's not a mechanical transfer of information. It's this creative process within, you know, that's occurring within each child, you know, as their selves and development unfolds. It is totally fueled by the imagination, and play is what keeps that imagination fresh and alive.
And that's true, whether it's an individual learning something that we as the human race collectively say no, like, you know, learning algebra, say. But it's even kind of more starkly true in someone acquiring knowledge about the world for the first time for the human race, you know, such as a scientist learning, you know, that there's another planet out there or so on. That requires creativity and imagination to even ask the right question and figure out how to get the answer to it.
No, that's absolutely it. A great Dutch philosopher wrote a book just before World War II, just before he was captured by the Nazis, actually, called in Latin Homo Ludens, which in English means man the player. He made a case for all culture, all human culture, being based on play. And so he would say, you know, literature is, and poetry is playing with words. Music is playing with sounds and tempos and so on. Art, you know, playing with color, playing with shapes. He even looked at law. He looked at other, you know, sort of non, what we would think of as non-creative cultural institutions, still reduced to it's playing with things. That's where the impetus, that's where the energy for them, that's where the original, the creative, the ideas that created them came out of this primordial sense and kind of instinct, you know, to play.
In your school, you have children who in many other schools would probably be diagnosed as ADHD and given drugs to control their behavior.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about how and why you don't proceed with kids in that way and how that connects with this notion of play that we've just been talking about?
Ever since I've been at the school, because our school is different, doesn't practice the usual carrot and stick, sit in your desks approach, we tended to attract kids, you know, that weren't fitting in to that model. You know, those aren't the only kids we attract, but you know, always at least a third of the kids that would show up, that was why they showed up. It wasn't so much that the parents bought into our philosophy, they just were kind of desperate, you know, their kids weren't fitting in anywhere else, and thankfully they had the good instinct to want to try to find some place where their kids, you know, could fit in. You know, I just got to watch how that works all these years, and you know, fast forward, you know, I started teaching in 73, so fast forward to say the mid-90s, I guess that's when it was, I can't remember, but so when ADD then, there was no ADHD, at first it was ADD, hit the headlines, you know, this is why Johnny can't read, you know, this is why Johnny can't sit still, this is why Johnny this or that, oh, he has this, you know, medical disorder, he's got this disease. I just thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard of. I mean, it already made no sense to me. I said, wait a minute, no, this is crazy. This is insane. Because every child that I've ever known and that I've worked with who maybe, you know, is out of control sometimes or can't, you know, can't harness their own energy and modulate it, can't control their impulses, can't control their perceptual apparatus well enough to learn to read, or, you know, whatever it might be. Because I've known lots of those kids. The explanation for me for why that child, a given child, might be, you know, kind of out of balance in this way or that way, was in their story. You know, I knew their story. I knew what their families were like. I knew. Maybe I even knew their grandparents, whatever. I really knew their story. And it was just so clear to me almost from the very beginning that their story and their way of being in the world just matched. I mean, it was just so plain to me. It wasn't that these kids had a disease or that they had a chemical imbalance in their brain, that was the explanation for why they were agitated or too angry or couldn't decipher lines of symbols, or it just didn't make sense to me. I just immediately said, no, this can't be right. And, you know, I did some research I wanted to be a little more scientific about it so I could truly reassure parents that this was a crazy idea, and that the idea of then giving kids powerful drugs to alter that brain chemistry in such a way that the attention centers in their brain, you know, kind of had no choice but to, you know, that their physical activity, you know, slumped off, but their brain focusing centers, you know, were still working, so that they would sit there and look at the worksheet and go through the kind of simple, whatever the simple task was. So I did the research, and the research actually bears that out. There's still no real scientific evidence supporting this idea that there's such a, that there's this disease.
So it's really just
that
behavior
to cure.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. Maybe we don't even know. I mean, children are mysterious. There's still plenty we don't know about, you know, the human psyche and so on. You know, I don't pretend to know it all. But we were just clear from the beginning in my school that we weren't going to medicate these kids, because it's not good for them. The stuff is very toxic, very powerful. And kids become very dependent on it. And it just tended not to be an issue in our school. I mean, a new child might come in with one of these labels, and yeah, they might be sort of off the wall in the beginning, but given, you know, given some time to adjust to this very new environment where they were allowed to be physical, and they were allowed to be noisy, and they were allowed to, you know, pretty much do what they wanted to do, focus on the things they wanted to focus on, as opposed to have to sit there in that damn desk and focus on these meaningless worksheets or you know, whatever the routine was, they would be fine. You know, they just weren't a problem. They weren't a problem to themselves. They weren't a problem to anyone else. You know, this idea that they had no attention spans was ridiculous, because you would pretty quickly, once they got used to this wildly new environment and used to not having the drugs in their system, they would focus for hours on the things they wanted to focus on. You know, it might be skateboard tricks or gymnastics or building something in the wood shop, or, you know, it might not have been an academic, often tended not to be, you know, sort of an academic left brain mental task. It would tend to be something artistic. You know, you'd see one of these so-called ADD children who, you know, had a 5-minute attention span just pouring themselves into a drawing for 2 hours at a time.
So
where's the chemical imbalance in the brain that prevents them, you know, that they're diseased, you know, they physically cannot pay attention until you change that chemical balance with these powerful drugs.
So, and here we have, you know, older adults who are running out of energy and wish we had more, we're saying these kids have too much energy.
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes, some kids are more energetic. I mean, it's not like some of these kids that we're talking about became just calm, placid children. I mean, they still, you know, were very high energy. They didn't sit still a whole lot. You know, they were on the move, and they liked to do things that were physical and active. They weren't real keen on sitting for hours reading novels, and they may never. Maybe that's just the way they are. You know, we are different. We all have different characteristics and temperaments. And
but what a great thing to have a lot of energy.
Exactly. Why do you want to take that away? Yeah.
In your new book, In Defense of Childhood, you mentioned that it was initially rejected by a publisher because you weren't enough of a specialist in their eyes. And so what qualified you to write this book where you were taking on all of, you know, culture and education and medicine and so on? And your response was, well, that's exactly why I'm the person to write it, because I have the big picture. And that led me to wonder about the kids in your school. Would you say that there are more generalists than specialists, or does that question not really even come up? Would you say that the kind of education they get there inclines them to see the big picture?
That's a good question.
I'm just kind of wondering, because they're not getting segregated.
Kids are different. I mean, some kids like to specialize more than others. Some kids are very, you know, if you look at the reality that we now know, you know, neuroscientists have really studied this. You know, the brain is specialized. We all, to one extent or another, have brains that specialize in one thing or another, or some of us have more balanced brains than other. But I mean, especially there's this idea that there's a right side of the neocortex and a left side, and each side has its specialties, right? The left brain specializes in analysis and dealing with sequential data, language. The right brain, you know, deals in wholes, images. The right brain is where the imagination pretty much sits, and so on. So with children, you see right away that some kids are more right brain than others, some are more left brain than others, some are fairly balanced. You know, there's that whole spectrum. I think it tends to be the intensely left, that whole idea of really specializing in one thing. Like you get geeky kids that just love math and they're just like brilliant at it. I mean, those are really, you don't see those kids drawing sometimes too much. You know, you don't see them much into music. They're just very left brain. Their brain is highly specialized or highly, you know, out of balance even. And then you have the opposite. You have extremely right brain kids. All you ever see them do is you see them drawing and putting on plays, and they're kind of dreamy a lot of the time, you know. And, you know, they live in this magical world of, you know, because their imaginations are just on the go all the time. Their whole reality is imaginative, because that's what the right brain is all about. You know, and you, sometimes those kids don't learn to read until, I don't know, 8, 9, 10. Mm-hmm. Partly because they don't really want to learn to read. It doesn't do anything for them. And partly because they kind of can't. Their brain hasn't, the left brain, which does that sequential decoding, hasn't somehow developed enough. It's not that they couldn't do it, but it's too much work. Who wants to do that? You know, if you just leave those kids until the left brain has matured a little bit more to where it's actually easy to learn to read, as easy as it is for the left brain kids who learn when they're 3 or 4 or 5, you know, they'll learn to read fine, no problem.
It just seems to me that our traditional education aspires to make us generalists in the beginning, like everybody takes all the same subjects,
right.
And then suddenly we're asked to be specialists in college, like choose a major, and many kids don't know what to choose because they've never been given very many choices other than, well, you're going to take French or German, you know. And it seems to me that in your school it might be that specialists are allowed to be specialists, but perhaps because you don't have things segregated by subject, maybe they also are good at connecting, you know, seeing the big picture as well.
So. I think so.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about this car you're driving around in, your biodiesel VW?
It's a Volkswagen Jetta with a turbo diesel engine. It looks like any other Volkswagen Jetta from the outside. You would never know the difference. The thing about diesel engines that most of us, I didn't realize until maybe a year or two ago, diesel engines were invented originally to burn anything oily. So when I converted my car to burn, use vegetable oil, I didn't have to do anything to the engine. But for a variety of reasons, you have to plumb in a whole second fuel system. Because the vegetable oil fuel system just has to completely run in parallel to the diesel fuel system. So it was kind of a day-long plumbing job, along with a couple of electronic valves that allow you to switch back and forth. I'm driving 7,000 miles, so at current diesel prices, which is the diesel's actually gone up quite a bit in the last few weeks. I don't know, I'm probably saving anywhere between $500 and $1,000 over the course of the tour. So
that's great.
That's a lot of money for me. Mm-hmm. And yes, to make I want to just make that point, and because it's a much more environmentally friendly fuel. We're not sort of adding to the carbon load in the atmosphere.
Towards the end of your book, you discuss some ideas for reversing this trend of taking childhood away from children and deadening their inner wildness. And some of these we've already discussed. Are there some others you could tell us about?
Yeah, sure. I, there's a lot of really simple ones that don't cost. I mean, that's the point I try to make about kind of the cure for this domestication of childhood, is that undomesticated experience tends to be, doesn't have to be, but it tends to be very basic, you know, very elemental. Like when we take the kids up to the corner park at school, you know, they don't even want to bring toys, but all they need is some sticks. They'll take some sticks, and who knows what they'll turn those sticks into. And then they're engaged in this beautiful, wild, elemental play that is nourishing their inner wildness. So just the simple act of reading to your kids, turning off all the electronic stuff, and just getting back to good old-fashioned reading at bedtime is a powerful thing. You know, 30 minutes a night, especially, I think it is important what parents read to kids. I mean, it's totally important that they not turn it into a teaching session. Introduce that control of, well, here, how about I read a page and you read a page, or what's this word, or no, nothing. You can't have that other agenda of turning it into a lesson. It just has to be for its own sake, the joy of exciting literature, plus the wonderful bonding that goes on at bedtime between parent and child when you have that quiet time together. So read really cool, exciting stuff that kids are just totally into. It's an incredibly powerful thing. Another key step is a not doing that I think parents have lost sight of. I just say to parents, leave your kids alone sometimes. They need time to be alone, or not with you, not with adults. Either they need time just with their buddies, their friends, in an unmediated environment, or they need time alone. I have a whole chapter in the book on solitude. Solitude is completely disappearing from Western life, adults and children. But and solitude is so important to us, especially to inner wildness. Inner wildness just has to have some solitude to breathe in. Let your kids play outside without watching them. Don't buy them so many damn toys that mediate their play. They don't need that stuff. You know, and so on. Just let them be. Not all the time, but let them be enough so that they can explore the world on their own terms and make mistakes, and let them take some risks. And, you know, what risks you let them take is, you know, obviously a matter of personal taste. You can't tell parents to let their kids climb a tree that they might fall out of and break their collarbones or even break their necks. I mean, that's up. But let them take, just recognize that risk is a teacher. And I go out on a limb, so, in the book, to say that injury, actually, you know, non-fatal injury, non-permanent injury, can be a great teacher. That children, it's a powerful experience that children learn a great deal from.
We learn from mistakes, don't we?
But I mean even injury, real physical injury, you know, that we all live in such fear of now. We do everything possible under the sun to prevent any kind of personal injury. And I think that's a mistake we've gone. Well, that just adds to this domestication. You're taking away kind of a wild aspect of experience that children need to feed that inner place.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Thank you for listening to The Learning Edge, published by Wetware Media. For more information about Wetware Media, please visit www.wetwaremedia.com. That's WETWAREMEDIA.com. If you'd like more information about Stephen Harrison, please visit his website, www.doingnothing.com, or write to him at P.O. Box 6071, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Stephen Harrison's books are available at Sentient Publications. For more information, please visit www.sentientpublications.com or call toll-free 866-588-9846. If you'd like more information about Chris Mercoliano, please visit his website, www.chrismercoliano.com. That's chrismercoliano.com. Or write to him at 3 Wilbur Street, Albany, New York, 12202.